Okay. Let's get started. What questions do people have? No questions. If you don't ask me a question, I'll tell you more about parsers. Yep, that inspired a question. Yes?
Yesterday, there was no uploaded.
Yes, I just checked. It's still not uploaded. So as soon as I go back from class, I will make sure that it gets uploaded. There is a tutorial for this week. This week's tutorial is a two-week tutorial. And we expect you to have sort of gotten halfway through so you can get feedback on it at your tutorial session this week and then finish it off next week. You can bring, those of you who've done the mock exam can bring questions about that to your tutorial, but obviously don't show it to the people who haven't done it yet. And then we'll be returning marked mock exams at your tutorial next week. So next week, you'll review your final tutorial as well as the mock exam, so there'll be a lot to cover. So thanks for that question. If you haven't seen anything about this week's tutorial by the end of the afternoon, do email me, and that will prod me to sort it out. Sometimes I get to be an absent-minded professor, and I leave here thinking, right, I've got to get this sorted out. And I go to my office, I go, now what was I going to do? So that's not so good. But we should have it sorted by the end of the afternoon. Right, any other questions? Did your brains hurt after parsers? Some people are being honest and nodding. Good. How many people really liked parsers? No one is admitting to it at all. Okay, so that was sort of the hardest it gets. You've climbed up to the top of the mountain, and now we're going to sort of go zooshing down like on a roller coaster. So today we're still going to see some material that I think some people will find difficult. I'm hoping a little bit less difficult than yesterday's material. In fact, it includes yesterday's material as a special case. But I think because it's more general, it's actually a bit easier to follow. And you will find that Haskell actually has support to make things like parsers easier for you. So now that we've made parsers hard, we're going to try to make them a bit easier and give you help to make use of them. And then next week, we're going to spend, if I'm remembering this right, every now and then during the lectures, I've said, now this way of doing things is a little bit less efficient, but don't worry about that unless you really need to know about efficiency. So we'll say some more serious things about efficiency at the first lecture. That's sort of a review to put the material about efficiency into the proper place. And then the final lecture will just be the weirdest idea you've ever seen. Okay. Basically, I'm going to explain, okay, I'm going to put it in this way, but don't take this too seriously. But I'm going to explain why Haskell was given to us by God. Now, that's a weird way of putting it because I don't believe in God, and it will get Dawkins out shooting me or something. But roughly speaking, that's sort of the best way I can put it. I'll ask you for a better way to put it at the end of the lecture. So that's what we're doing next week. So for this week, we are going to cover how to get Haskell to actually do something. So just to review before we do that, any questions? Oh, I think this slide's slightly out of date. I think I better change that one. Wow, it's really out of date. I definitely better change that one. The deadline is not 12 p.m. Friday, 27th November, 2007. The deadline is this Thursday at 4 p.m. I'll get that fixed. My apologies. And this one I did update to 2010. So this is the reading, and I just wanted to put this up to remind you that at this point you should have all the reading done. And we've got a lot of material to cover this lecture. I'm going to especially invite at the beginning of the next lecture any questions you have from anything you've read or anything we've covered in the course. All right, now's your chance to get in with questions. Do think up some good questions. I'm sure you have some from the course. You know, like, what is all this abstraction stuff? Why do we really need to bother with it? Things like that. Do bring your questions for next Monday, okay? And do try to get the reading done by then, so if you have questions about it, you can ask them. Of course, you can always ask demonstrators or tutors or anybody about questions you have as well. Any questions about that? How are people doing with the reading? How many people have actually made it through to the end of the book? A few hands going up, but not too many. How many people have not read the book? A few hands going up, but not too many. Right? If you've not read the book and you don't do well on the exam, don't blame me. Right? The book is there to help you. You should take advantage of that. So I do encourage you to finish reading the book. Right? We assigned it for reading, and it gives you a different perspective on many of the things I've covered, including parsers. Okay, let's get serious and practical. Let's talk about the mind-body problem. How many of you have had philosophy classes discussing this? A few of you, right. So you know about the mind-body problem. Among the other people who commented on it was this man who recognizes this fellow. Yes? Descartes, correct. This is René Descartes. So René Descartes had this minor problem. He didn't know if the world existed. Right? He had senses of it, but just because he has senses of it doesn't mean the world is really there. Maybe it was all just in his mind. How could he be sure that anything was real? Right? And he finally came to the conclusion that something was real, that he was real. Right? His argument for that was he was aware of himself thinking. So hence we had cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And he was interested in the question of how does this brain, which we have direct perception of, relate to our bodies? How can our body do anything? And he felt that everybody must have an immortal soul. He actually, starting on this very firm ground of I think, therefore I am, he got to the point of saying, well, clearly God must exist. And I'll let you read his argument about how him being able to think implies the existence of God. And then he got to the point that everybody must have an immortal soul. So then there's the question, how does this mind, this soul, attach to the body? Right? If the soul is ethereal and the body is physical, where do they connect? And there's an obvious answer, he decided, shown in this figure. Can you see what the answer is? It's this little gland in your brain, the pineal gland. The pineal gland, according to Descartes, is where your soul connects to your body. And he had good evidence for this, right? If you look at the brain, everything is doubled. Right? You've got two eyes, you've got two hemispheres to the brain. There's two of everything. But your brain connects to your soul only once, and there's just one pineal gland centrally located. So that's why he figured this must be what the pineal gland is for. It connects your soul to your body, because there's only one of it, and there's two of everything else. Right? He said, part of his argument was that if there were two places where the soul connects, you'd see everything double, and you don't. He clearly never got drunk. Okay? So the pineal gland, according to Descartes, is where the soul connects to the body. The mind and the body connect at the pineal gland. Okay, now what on earth does this have to do with Haskell? Well, Haskell is great for computing values, right? That's what we've learned. You write a function, and you apply it to the function itself is a value. You apply the function to an argument, which is another value, and you get back a value. And values can have all sorts of types, right? The type of a value might be a character, or a number, or a list, which could be a list of characters, or a list of numbers, or it might be a function, or it might be a list of functions, or it might be a list of characters, or it might be a list of value string pairs, or what have you. Right? There are all sorts of interesting values that we've got. But a value isn't the same as doing something. Right? Turn on the lights in my room. Fire the missiles at the island over there, or what have you. So, we are now going to discuss how you do things in Haskell. And the way you do things is we have a particular type called I/O, which is the type of commands. So we're going to turn doing things into a value. So the type of commands is the type of orders to do something. So for instance, putchar takes a character and it returns one of these things, I/O of empty tuple. So I/O of empty tuple means this is going to be a list of commands, do all these commands, and when you're done, return the empty tuple. We'll generalize that in a moment. So for instance, putchar of the character exclamation mark denotes the command that if it is ever performed, will print an exclamation mark. In other words, it's a value like everything else. It's a command that describes the act of printing an exclamation mark, but it doesn't necessarily print an exclamation mark. And then we can combine commands to build larger commands. So the double arrow, the double greater than operation, takes two commands, and it does both of them in order. So putchar question mark followed by putchar exclamation mark is the command that, if you ever did it, would print a question mark followed by an exclamation mark. And we also have a special command, done, which stands for do nothing. Now it doesn't actually do nothing. It's the command that if you ever did it, it would do nothing. Okay? So it's a little bit like the difference between thinking about doing nothing and actually doing nothing, right? They're different. Right? You're all doing something right now. You're attending a lecture, but you might be thinking about doing nothing. So now we can do something like write the program that, take given a string, will print the string on the terminal, if you ever did it. Right? So putString of the empty string should be, well, there's nothing to print, do nothing. Putstring of the string whose head is x and whose tail is x's, how would you do that? Well, first you'd write out the x, and then recursively you'd write out the remainder of the string. So for instance, putstring of question mark exclamation mark would end up being the same as putchar question mark, putchar exclamation mark, and then, oops, I've said return empty there. That should say done. That's a typo. Is my typo person here? Can you send me that typo, please? There's another typo on the slides describing this week's slides describing the programming contest. So that's two typos. Does everybody, right, this is just an ordinary recursive Haskell function that should be quite boring to you. Is it clear to people how this works? Question. No, your hand went up. Right. So you weren't thinking about doing nothing, you were doing something. Okay, any questions about that? Is that clear enough? Nod if it's clear enough. Right, some people are nodding. But you didn't nod. You're rubbing your eyes. Is that clear enough? You have to nod then. Okay, we'll take a smile as a nod. Okay. And notice that, right, if you really want to use higher order functions, you could do that. What we're actually doing, a different way of doing this same thing, you'd be familiar with this by now, is to map putchar over the string. So we've replaced our list of characters by a list of actions to print a character. And then what is foldar of double greater than and done, right? It gives, given a list, it uses double greater than to combine things, right? And that works because it's very similar to plus and zero, or times and one, or double plus and empty list, all these things that we've seen. Because just like all of those, the operator greater than is associative, right? Remember the first two questions you're supposed to ask if you meet an operator, right? Here's the operator double greater than. What do you say? Are you associative? Does it matter how you're parenthesized? No, it doesn't matter at all. M followed by N followed by zero, followed by O, sorry, not zero, is the same as M followed by N followed by O. Right? Can you see why that's true? If you combine, if we're combining three actions, we can first combine two of them and then add on the third. As long as we do it in the right order, it Doesn't matter how we do that combination. Similarly, M followed by doing nothing is, of course, the same as M. Doing nothing followed by M is the same as M. So we've just answered the other question that you want to ask an operator when you meet it, which is, do you have an identity? Right, so done is the identity for double greater than. Any questions about that? Okay, fine. So we know how to combine commands to do bigger commands, but how do you actually do something? Well, here's how we do something. There's a special function in Haskell called main. So main always has the type IO of empty tuple, and whatever you define main to be, that's what the program will do. So if I had this program that defines main to be put string exclamation mark question mark, and I execute this program run GHC over that. So run GHC is a lot like GHCI, except it just does what main says to do. So it does it, and it prints question mark, exclamation mark. And it does exactly what it was told to do. Ooh, I think I see another typo. Right, so he said print exclamation mark, question mark. So it will print exclamation mark, question mark. It just does that, it doesn't even print a new line. So the next feedback that you get is still on the same line. So this is exactly like Descartes' pineal gland. There's exactly one place where thinking about an action or describing an action turns into an action, which is main. Main is the pineal gland of Haskell. Now that seems, you know, completely silly. How could there be just one place where things connect? But we will see that commands can contain entire programs, entire responses to actions. So it's actually very powerful. It might seem a little bit silly, but it's actually as powerful as anything you could want to do. So it's very easy, right, to define a command that means put a print a string followed by a new line. Right, we just print the string and follow that by printing the new line character. So now if we do put string line, it's much more sensible because it actually puts a new line before the next bit. So this is what we would tend to use in practice. Is there a question? Now, notice that this is, of course, not what you do in most programming languages. For those of you that have experience with programming languages other than Haskell, you'd know that what you would typically do is you'd have some command like output, and output says, print the output here, and here's the string to print. So if you say output to the standard output ha, and you say it twice, it'll, of course, print ha-ha. But notice it's doing that just as a side effect. So if you say something, let x be the value returned by calling output on the standard output in ha, and then do x twice, the laugh is on you. Because it will only print ha, not ha-ha. Right? Printing ha is a side effect of computing this value. So in most languages, what you do is a side effect of computation. And you need to keep track of where the side effects occur. In Haskell, there are no side effects. There are only values. So as we'll see, the equivalent of this in Haskell works perfectly well. So if you want to preserve where the side effects occurred in standard ML or some other language, you'd need to make sure that this side effect was performed as the result of calling a function. And then you'd have to call that function twice to get the effect twice. Now, in Haskell, if you say 1 plus 2 times 1 plus 2, and you say let x equal 1 plus 2 and x times x, they both mean exactly the same thing, right? Similarly, in Haskell, we want it to be the case that if you say put string ha followed by put string ha, and you say let m be put string ha, in M followed by M, that it means the same thing. So both of these denote the command that if it's ever performed, prints ha-ha. And so this distinction between doing something and describing doing something is essential. In ML, output does something. It doesn't describe doing something. It actually does it right then. So for those of you who are impatient, that's probably a good thing. But for those of you who are interested in equational reasoning, then it's not so good, because it actually makes it harder to understand what's going on. You need to keep track of side effects separately from values. In Haskell, there are only values. And equational reasoning is the fancy word we used for playing dumb computer, for starting with a value and then seeing what that value is equal to and then seeing what that value is equal to and so on. We just had a long string of equations. This is equal to this is equal to this is equal to this. And we could work out everything we needed to about our Haskell programs in that way. We didn't need to worry about, did something happen while we were doing this? We only needed to worry about what is the value. So this way of doing input and output preserves this property, that we only need to worry about what is the value. OK, so that's a good place to start. But that's fine for output. What about input? What if the command I want to do is read a character from the terminal? Now you need a command that has a value, namely the character that it read from the terminal. So in general, instead of writing IO of empty tuple, we write IO of some type. So for instance, write IO is a parameterized type, just like list, just like parser. So IO of char is the command that, if you ever execute it, will return a character. And getchar is the particular command of that type that reads one character and returns it. Right. And in general, we write IO of A for a command that returns an A. And in particular, remember I wrote return of empty by mistake before? That's the same as done, because what return does is, given an A, it returns the command that does nothing and returns an A. So for instance, return empty list could have, if this empty list was an empty list of characters, it would have the type IO of string. So for instance, if the, let's say the input here is ABC and we do getchar, what happens? Well, it's going to return the value A, and the remaining input would be changed now. We've read the A, the remaining input is BC. If we do return of empty list, and the input contains DEF, well, it's going to return the value empty list, and the input's going to stay the same. Nothing's going to be read. It'll still be DEF. We've done nothing. And just as double greater than combines two commands that do nothing, we use double greater than equal to perform a command that yields a value and get hold of that value and do something with it. Now, the type here looks a bit complicated. This is the one tricky bit. And this operator, I'm going to stop pronouncing it double greater than equal, because that's hard to say. I'm going to call it bind, because that's what it does. So for instance, so the first argument to bind is an IO of A, as do something and return an A. The second argument is a function, which takes an A and returns an IO of B. And the result of the whole command is an IO of B. So this is the command that reads a character and echoes it to the terminal in uppercase. So for instance, if the input was ABC, read is going to return it a lowercase a. The remaining input's going to be BC. And then we'll do to upper of that character. So we'll convert it to uppercase A, and then we'll print it on the terminal. So in this case, A is the type char, because this returns a character. And B is the type empty tuple, because put char has type IO empty tuple. It doesn't return any value at all. And then this whole thing will be a command that doesn't return anything at all. It just does something. What does it do? Reads a character from the terminal, echoes it in uppercase. So the second argument to this is a function that says, let me take x, which was the value that this returned, convert it to uppercase, and then print it on the terminal. Of course, this doesn't actually do it. It's just the command that, if you ever executed it, would do it. And we're combining these two commands to get a bigger command. That if you ever executed it, it does first what the first one says, applies the function to that value, which gives another command, and then does what that one says. So notice that the type of this thing is something that does stuff and returns a value of type B. So that's why its type is I O of B. It doesn't have an A in it, because the A was returned by this and then passed on to this function. Of course, B might be something like a list of A, so that it'll be very easy to have commands that read in lots of characters and then return all of them at once. We'll see how to do that in a minute. Okay, so this is just a review, an abstract of what we said, right? So if M is a command of type IOA, and K, which stands for continuation, takes an A and returns an IO of B, then M bind K is an IOB. And if it was ever performed, what would it do? It would first do M, which will return an A. It applies, let's call that X, the value returned. It applies K to X, which is going to yield another value, Y, of type B. And then finally, what it does is it's the command, okay, that returns that particular value y. So here's the program to read in a line of characters. So getLine says, get the character, call that x. Let's look at x. If x is the new line character, we're done. Return the empty list. Otherwise, recursively call getLine, so that'll get the remainder of the input line, call that x's, and then return the character we just read, x, appended onto x's. So let's say the input was abc new line def. Then what that will do is it will first read an a, right? The first get char returns an a, and the remaining input is bc new line def. So we check, is a the same as new line? No. So then we call getLine again with BC new line DEF, and that will return recursively the string BC and the remaining input DEF. So when we're all done, we then cons A onto BC, we get the list ABC, so we return ABC, and the remaining input is DEF. Is it clear to people how that works? Any questions about that? Nod your head if that made sense. You didn't nod your head. You get to ask a question.
Me?
Yeah. You did understand. Okay. Yes?
So what's the difference between the string it returns and the remaining input?
What's the difference between the string it returns and the remaining input?
Can we access the remaining input somehow?
How can you access the remaining input? By doing more get char operations. Right? So to get at the input, you have to do a get char. Okay. And the general operations are return and bind. Right? So return takes an A and returns the command that does nothing. It just returns that A immediately. We've seen the type of bind. And notice that, right, done and next, the double greater than operation, are just special instances of return and bind. So done is return of the empty tuple, right? Do nothing, return the empty tuple. Next is just M followed by N is do an M, get the result. That result must be the empty tuple. So we've got a function that takes the empty tuple as an argument and returns the other action n to be done. So this could just be a variable x that we ignore. Right? We don't care about the value returned by this. It's always just the empty tuple. Okay? But this is just like let. It's like the let in ML that can have side effects. Right? So in ML, right, if M is an expression of type A, and N is an expression of type B, which has X as a free variable, right, then let X equal M in N has type B. And you can see that these things all map to the types in bind. Right? This is an expression of type A, so it corresponds to an IO of A. This is an expression of type B, so it corresponds to an IO of B, but it has an X of type A as input, so this whole bit corresponds to the function lambda xn, which is a function from an A to an IO of B. So we can sort of read the types of bind off of the way the types in let work. So here's a program that now reads in a whole line and echoes it to the terminal, but in uppercase. Right? So we can do get line, call that thing line. And we're going to keep doing this until we read an empty line. So if the line is empty, we're done. Return the empty tuple. Otherwise, write out on the line we were given, but turn every letter in it to uppercase. And then do echo again. And then we'll say main is the same as echo. So this is a program we can type things in, and it will copy them back in uppercase. Right? So if I run this thing, I type one line, it echoes back one line, and another line, and another line. And then next I typed just a new line, so it was an empty line. So then it said, all right, I'm done. Okay? Did people see how that works? It's a sport. If I've done it right, you should be bored by now. Are people bored? Good. Some people are bored. Excellent. Okay, so that's basically all there is to it, but now we have some special notation in Haskell that makes this a little bit easier to do. It's called do notation. So what we just had was the getLine program, right, which was written this way. In Haskell, you can instead write it like this. Do X gets drawn from getChar. If X is new line, then as before, return the empty line. Otherwise, do let X's be drawn from getLine and return X const onto X's. So instead of getLine bind lambda variable arrow the rest of it, we just write that in a slightly different order. We write do's around the whole thing, and then instead of the bind, we write X's drawn from command. So here we wrote command bind lambda variable, and then the rest of the function body. And here we just say X is drawn from getLine semicolon. This was a huge advance when we figured out how to do this in Haskell. The huge advance is, if you know C or you know Java, this looks just like C or Java because it has curly braces in it, and it has semicolons. So it looks just like what you would do in any other language. And so this made people much more comfortable with writing Haskell. Okay. And then echo can be written in just the same way. So this is what we call syntactic sugar. It's a different way of writing things down, and it just converts into this other way. Right? You've seen lots of examples of that, where you write things one way in Haskell and they're equivalent to some other way of writing things. Sections are an example of that, where if you write plus three, it's an abbreviation for something else. So in general, right, if you write do thingy drawn from thingy, thingy drawn from thingy, it becomes right, value drawn from command, it becomes command bind lambda the variable, and command bind lambda the next variable, and so on. So it's a very easy translation to do. So that's all there is to it. There's a name for this thing. It is called a monad. And the name monad was picked in part because it looks a lot like monoid. Okay. You've seen lots and lots of monoids by now. You might not know it. But a monoid is just an operator and a value u, where u is the unit for the operator, and the operator is associative. Right? So u at x must be x, x at u must be x, and x at y at z is the same as x at y at z parenthesized the other way. Right? So you've seen lots of examples of this, plus and zero, times and one, plus plus an empty list, and even next command and do nothing are all examples of monoids. Right? Or in false and in true are other examples. Everybody's really familiar with monoid, you just didn't know that was what it was called. Right? It's like the fellow who said, oh, I've been writing prose my whole life, I just didn't know it. Right? You've been using monoid your whole life. So a monad is very similar, except the types are a bit different, right? So in fact, return is the unit for bind. Because if you do return v, and then in bind, and then lambda xm, well, that's the same as m with x replaced by v. And if you do m followed by lambda x return x, that says m, let the value of m be x, and then do nothing except return x, well, that's the same as m. And even better, if you say do m, let the result be x, do n, let the result be y, do o, it really doesn't matter which way you parenthesize that. Here we've said do n, let the result be y, and do o. And if we do that after saying, well, do m, let the result be x, and then do this combined thing, well, what in both cases, we're doing m, the result of doing m is x, we do n, the result of doing n is y, and then we do o. So these are both the same. So it doesn't matter how you parenthesize it. So it's very similar to a monoid, and it's called a monad. This idea comes from a branch of mathematics called category theory, which is fairly abstract. Monads were first developed for doing algebraic topology, something completely different than getting your program to execute commands. And in fact, a monad consists of three things: its type, its unit, and the bind operation. So there were three things in a mathematical monad. So at first it was called a triple, which is sort of like the mathematical equivalent of calling something, hey, you. And then after a while, the category theorists thought, well, this actually crops up a lot. It's sort of like a monoid. Let's call it a monad. They picked monad because, do you remember our friend Leibniz, who came up with the rule of equality? He also wrote a lot of philosophy about monads. For instance, Leibniz wrote this sentence, God is a monad. If you look carefully at what he was writing about, what monads were to Leibniz were abstract data types. Right? Remember all the work we did on types that don't export part of their representation? So you can hide the way in which things are represented? That's what monads are. He wrote about monads. They have no windows through which you can view their interior. So basically what Leibniz wrote in his philosophy, the thing he thought was one of the most important things he did, was God is an abstract data type. But he gave us the name monad. And in let notation, the laws for a monad look like this. And this last one, if you're familiar with let, would actually look very familiar. But most of you aren't, so I won't go into that. And then let satisfies certain kinds of equational laws, even in languages with effects, which correspond to the laws satisfied by a monad. So we've saved equational reasoning, a part of it, for even languages like ML. And basically, it says as long as these things are values, then it behaves the way we expect. In Haskell, this works not just for values, but for any expressions whatsoever. Right? Ha ha was an example of this. Okay, so now I can show you the details of how you'd actually write the IO monad if you wanted to. So there's a type class in Haskell called monad, which has two operators in it, return and bind. And so this is very handy because Haskell actually uses these notations, they're sort of built into Haskell, but you can define your own instances of the type class. So you can define your own monads. But let's look at how we would define I/O. So what an I/O would be is it takes an input and it returns a value and the remainder of the input and perhaps some output that it should print. So it will be a function from a string to a tuple consisting of a value, the string which is the remainder of the input, and a string which is the output. And then to apply it, right, we're again using this abstract data constructor, myIO. So we would just extract the function and the input and apply that function to the input to get the necessary tuple. So putchar then just says, given the input, return no value, the same input, we didn't read any input, and a list consisting of that character, that outputs that character. Getchar, the input must begin with the character and have a remainder, and then we return the character as the value, we return the remainder as the remaining input, and we don't do any output. So we're either affecting the output or the input. And then here's several examples of how that would work. Right, so if you do my jet car on ABC, you get A followed by BC followed by no output. So this is the remaining input. And if we did the same thing when the remaining input was BC, we get B followed by the remainder C, no output, and so on. So now we need to define return and bind, but they're pretty simple, right? Return just says take the input, and then return the value you were given, x, the input unchanged, we've read nothing from it, the output list empty, we've written no output. So we do nothing except return the value x. And then for m followed by k, read the input, apply m to the input, you'll get back a tuple, x, remainder 1, output 1. Then we've got k here, apply k, right, take k and apply it to x. That gives us the other command. So we apply that to the remainder that was left after the first command, and we'll get a value y, and the remainder after the second command, and some more output. And what do we return? The value from the second command, what was left after we did both commands, and both outputs concatenated together. So for instance, if we do getchar, and then return both in a list to ABC, then that would return AB as the value, C as the remainder, and empty as the output. Whereas if we did write capital A followed by write a capital B with input DEF, doesn't change the input at all, and produces AB as output. And finally, if we did a getchar followed by lambda x, whoops, that should be an arrow. One more typo, please. There should be an arrow there. So lambda x, and then do, writing out in uppercase, if your input was ABC, you return no value at all, remaining input is BC, and of course your output is A. Do people see how that works? Does this remind you a little bit about how the parsers work? Because they had an input and a remaining unparsed input as well. This is actually quite similar. And then finally, right, we need to write a function, interact, that given a function from strings to strings, returns a command. And then it takes the input, passes that as the input string, and takes the output string, and actually prints it. So ultimately, you would need to write that as a function, as a primitive for I/O, for the actual Haskell thing that does the I/O. I'm going to skip over that one. There are other monads. I'm going to tell you about just a couple of them very quickly. We can define list to be a monad. So this says Lists are a monotype. So return, given an A has to return a list of A, what shall we do? Just return the list containing X and nothing else. So return of X is the unit list. And M followed by K, well, what do we do here? Well, we're given a list of A and a function from A to list of B, and we need to return a list of B. So what should we do? Well, let X be drawn from M. Let Y be drawn from K of X, right? Because we take each value returned in this list, apply the function to it, we get another list. Oh, we now have a list of lists, but we draw Y from that and return Y. So what this really does is it applies this function to every element of this list, gives us a list of lists. We concatenate those together to get our answer list. Wow, that looks pretty complicated. So that's what this is at. M bind K is just concat of map K over M. Wow, that seems really hard. Why would I want to do that? That gives me list comprehensions. If list comprehensions weren't built into Haskell, you could define them yourselves and then use them with do notation. So that instead of writing, for instance, list of all ij pairs, right? Ij, I drawn from 1 to n, j drawn from I plus 1 to n. So these are ij pairs where j is greater than I. We could just say do I drawn from 1 to n, j drawn from I plus 1 up to n, return the ij pair. This do expression behaves exactly like this list comprehension. And I'm going to skip over that and finally show you that all the parsers we were working with, that's just another monad. Maybe not too surprising, right? Because the two aspects of parsers are what we just saw. Take an input, return remaining unparsed input. That's just like what we were doing with commands to read the input. And when we returned values paired with remaining unparsed input, there was a list of them. So that's just like the list monad. List monad, by the way, is like the idea of having a program that you can execute that instead of returning one value, returns many values. That's exactly what a list is. There's some languages that are sort of non-deterministic. You run the program, you get one of the possible values it might return. You can model that using lists as a monad. That's exactly what's going on with parsers. It's one of the several possible parses gets returned. So here's our definition of parser from before. Here's our definition of apply and parse from before. And the important thing is we can now define return and bind in obvious ways. So return of X is the parser that, given the input string X, returns the list of one thing, which is an XS pair. You can see that combines the ideas and returns we saw before. And bind is the parser that takes an S, applies our first parser M to S, give us an X and remaining unparsed input T. Then you apply K, your next bit, to the value X returned by the first parser. This is a new parser. What string do we apply to? The remaining unparsed string T. That gives you a value Y, remaining unparsed string U, and you just return Y and U. This is very, very similar to the star, star, star operator that we saw before. If you go back and you look at this and you look at star, 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 you see they're doing very similar things. What do we get for doing that? I'll just skip to the end. We get do notation. Right? So here is our parser for expressions. Right? We parsed either a con or an add or a mul. So the first parser says, well, parse an int, let I be that int, return constructor applied to I. The next one says, do token of empty. This should actually be empty tuple drawn from token of empty, right? So we abbreviate empty tuple drawn from by saying nothing. It says, just do the command. I don't care about the value returned. So token of empty, read the input, open parenthesis, parse the expression, let D be its value.